Our special guest right now is Neil Howe, author of The Fourth Turning. So, you know, one thing that I've you know, talked about here on the show a bit, when our parents grew up, they were very kind of religious, very nuclear families, very focused on the family. Even the baby boomer generation was more of a nuclear structure. And kind of when we look at the generations now, there's less of this focus on religion, I guess, as it appears, and kind of even a less focus on this nuclear structure of the family. You know, it seems very easy today to file for divorce very quickly, right? It's not working out. It's not a function of, hey, we were married, we're going to stick through it through thick and thin. Does that change the dynamic potentially for economics and other things moving forward? Or is this just part of the cycle?
We've seen this repeatedly. You know, changes in gender roles are part of this changing generational cycle. Generations that come of age during these awakenings typically are less of a gap between gender roles than generations that come of age at a time of crisis, Rich. Mm-hmm. You stop and think about it. It kind of sounds understandable. And so that's not new. I mean, you can go back and look at the transcendental generation back in the 1820s and 30s, early 40s of Ralph Waldo Emerson and Hawthorne and Whitman. And I mean, the men had long hair. They founded Fourier communes all over the, all over the Midwest. Yeah. They founded religions. They were feminists. They were prophets. I mean, they were completely unlike many of their parents who founded this country, right? Completely straight-laced, very much a male-focused generation of, you know, we think of, Jefferson and Madison and Monroe, right? Mm-hmm. So this is not new. This is not new. And I think that, yes, we are seeing amazing contrasts in religion and everything else. I think it's not unusual to see a generation like millennials coming of age now to be less interested in religion and less interested in deep feelings about the culture in general than boomers were. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a typical pattern that we've seen in the past. You know, there's an old saying, sort of an interesting apocryphal story about someone coming up to these hero-type generations that come of age, you know, at a time of crisis. And someone came up to Hamilton or Madison just after they drafted the Constitution, and it was being sent out to all the various colonies or states to be approved. And someone came up, and the Constitutional Convention, by the way, had this very young group. It was very unlike the people who signed the Declaration of Independence. It was a whole new generation of younger people. And someone came up to them and said, you know, we're sort of shocked that nowhere in this Constitution do you mention God. There's no mention of the supreme deity. And so I believe it's Hamilton who was supposed to have said somewhat puckishly, you know, oh, yes, I guess we forgot, right? But you have to remember that the peers of Benjamin Franklin, they came of age with the Great Awakening. I mean, right. The older members of that experience were extremely drenched in not only religion, but in a kind of an apocalyptic religious vision that their kids did not have. Their kids were rationalists. I mean, their kids were at home in Enlightenment salons, you know, talking about the God of reason. A very different kind of generation came out of that. And I think that's something that's important that boomers remember in thinking of their kids. I mean, boomers have this high degree of, they're very values-oriented. They're very passionate about the culture. They think a lot about right and wrong and good and bad. And they have kids who are much more interested in just how things work and how people can reach consensus and how everyone can kind of get along without focusing so much on how strongly we feel about stuff. And I think when you get to know and you talk with a lot of millennials, that definitely is something that comes through.
Exactly. So this brings up the all important question here is that, so we've gone through this generational cycle. And as you said, you know, we're kind of in the late stage of this. We're in coming up in this election period. You're now advising some asset managers, my friends over there at Hedgeye in particular, good group of people. What is it that you see? I mean, when you're advising asset managers at this point, what are you telling them about where we are now in this generational cycle? Are there things that we need to be looking for, opportunities or concerns that we should be having?
Well, you know, a lot of what I do day to day is a lot of very particular industries and particular trends, you know, if it's gamification or cause marketing and things that affect particular products. I think in terms of our overall sense of where we locate ourselves in history, so in other words, if people are saying, well, you know, Neil, what kind of decade are we living through? what are we, if there is a cycle, if moods tend to come back around again, what's the most similar to what we're experiencing today? And what I will tell people is that I think there's very little question that what's most similar to what we're living through today is the decade of the 1930s. I say that for a number of reasons. You know, first of all, you just look at the economy. Right, the past 10 years, what have we been dealing with? You know, the underemployment of labor and capital, extremely low interest rates, you know, interest rates that are going down into, you know, zero or even in Europe, negative territory. Well, that was like the 30s, right? That was the Great Depression. We had no way of stimulating the economy. There was a liquidity trap. One of the most famous economists of the late 30s, who was bringing Keynes to the United States, coined the term, this was Alvin Hansen, secular stagnation, and you'll note that this was brought back to public prominence by Larry Summers just two or three years ago about talking about how America is gripped in secular stagnation. We see demographic growth stalled, right? Birth rates are down, just like in the 30s. And you look around even at the international scene, fears of trade wars, competitive devaluation. That's what we experienced in the 30s, right? Look around the world today. What's Europe trying to do? What's Japan trying to do, right? We're the ones who aren't playing along, right? And our manufacturers are suffering. You know, our industrial sector is suffering because of that. And even you look at geopolitics, the 30s were characterized by a period, you know, the League of Nations had basically crumbled to pieces, and it was a world in which there was no global power who supervised what was going on. And, you know, autocrats just basically did what they wanted to in their local area of the world. Well, you know, look around today, right? Mm-hmm. And even the rise of leaders who believed in decisive action, right, and wanted to break up the dysfunctional and institutions, decadent institutions that no longer worked, extreme frustration of electorates the world over. Well, you look at today, I'm reminded, in fact, that I see these unruly rallies where the Bernie Sanders people are disrupting the Trump rallies, and then Trump saying that, you know, he'll sick his guys on Bernie. And I'm reminded that in the 1930s, one thing you saw in capital cities across Europe was gangs of fascists and socialists fighting each other in the streets.
You know, you've brought up this 1930s scenario, and I'd like to ask you particularly, how does this end? We know how it ended in the 30s. We wound up in World War II. Well, how does this one end? And I want to ask you that because of all this, you know, Janet Yellen out today with, you know, here we are not going to raise rates, and we've got the ECB and everybody else trying to figure out how to stimulate the world economy. Nothing really seems to be working at this point. So I guess the question is, how does this end? Where we had secular stagnation, liquidity trap, something I've written about, you know, quite a few times. Also another issue that Larry Summers brought up not too long ago. So the question now is that when we look around at policymakers, and particularly in this case, monetary policymakers, whether it's the ECB, whether it's the Bank of Japan or the Federal Reserve, they're doing everything they can within limits to try to stimulate economic growth, trying to create some inflation. Nothing seems to be working at this point. So here's the question. We were doing very similar things back during the 30s to try to stimulate growth. It wasn't working then. Ultimately, we wound up in World War II, which kind of marked the end of that depressionary era. How does this depressionary era, even though people say we're not in a depression, but since we're comparing periods, how does this particular period potentially end? Do we just somehow magically grow our way out of a debt problem, or is there some type of crisis event that leads to the ability to grow our way from this point going forward?
I think the short answer is, just looking at earlier eras like this, is that it gets worse before it gets better. I mean, that's kind of the quick explanation. It needs to get bad enough so that and, you know, we're seeing that a little bit in politics now, given sort of the unusual complete crack up of any sort of established the established leadership of either party, right?
Right. But isn't this part of the millennial generation demanding difference? I mean, kind of in a way?
Well, yeah. I mean, they got on board. I mean, it's the same thing in Europe. Look at voters under 30. Mm-hmm. They're voting for nationalist parties. They're voting for Eurosceptic parties now. And you know, you never would have thought that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The same thing happening here. So what's going to happen is you need a break, an institutional break, where people say, okay, we need to really clear out all this stuff that doesn't work, and we really need to start over again. So that sense of institutional rebirth, which is really what we had, obviously, at the end of World War II, where, remember that we gave birth to, you know, the UN, the IMF, Bretton Woods, the World Bank. I mean, just this whole new set of not just national but global institutions. We're going to have to do something similar to that at the end of this crisis period, and it's going to take being pushed to the point where people will do it. I think people increasingly are being political. We see that in politics now, being pushed to that point. It doesn't take a total war. I will say that because, you know, you can do that in other ways. It's worth remembering that all of the great total wars in American history have been in these fourth turning periods. You know, as a useful reminder. But I don't think it requires war, but it does require a kind of a new sense of, you know, sort of collective effort on that everyone in some way participates in it to set up something new. And then, of course, that's the world in which millennials ultimately, you know, mature and become leaders, just as the greatest generation did in the post-war period.
It's an interesting, you know, statement thinking about, you know, the institutional system, and that, you know, in the financial crisis, you know, we didn't take that opportunity to break up the major banks. We protected Wall Street to a great degree. This has really worked to the demise of the millennials in many ways, because we had this kind of massive wealth transfer from the middle class to the upper class. We've now really exacerbated. There's always wealth inequality in any society. There's always the rich, there's always the poor, and there's always a bunch of people in the middle. Unfortunately, since the financial crisis and because of the actions that were taken by, you know, both political and Wall Street parties, we've really exacerbated that wealth inequality. We've shrunk the middle class, pushed a whole bunch of them down to the bottom end. Did we miss the opportunity at that point to potentially restructure the system then? And is this something that we're going to have to wind up doing, as you were talking about, in this next restructuring? Is that part of what we're going to have to do, is this? Because millennials, can't get a job. They can't get wage growth. You know, they're saddled with debt. You know, there's we haven't fixed any of the problems.
Yeah, I think that's right. You remember Obama's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, famously said back in 2009 that a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. Yep. And of course, they wasted it because they didn't do any. And they could have put anything through Congress. They could have taken huge steps to solve some of our long-term fiscal problems, and they could have, you know, they could have done a lot, even with the situation of the banks and financial regs. They didn't. Instead, what they ultimately ended up doing was huge loans and ultimately QE, which basically brought down interest rates, pushed up the prices of all existing assets so that older generations felt okay. And it was priced it completely out of reach of you know, the rising generation coming along.
Right.
And that's kind of how we settled it. That's not going to work. You know, that does not solve the problem. So it delayed it. And I think, if anything, it accentuates the ultimate kind of crash or readjustment we had to make. One interesting thing to remember is that, yes, in 1929, when the Gini coefficient, you know, the measure of inequality, reached its peak until, you know, recent years, the market, the economy crashed quite steeply and severely to 1932-33, where you had, you know, mm-hmm. to 25% reduction in GDP. But it's interesting, after those 4 years, GDP grew very strongly almost every year after that.
Yes.
Right up through World War II. So in a sense, the Great Depression was a lot briefer. I mean, if you're talking about the era of substandard growth, it fell dramatically, but then it expanded dramatically right up through Pearl Harbor and you know, just kept on speeding up as we got higher and higher labor force participation, and, you know, all the Rosie the Riveters were finally working, and that's kind of where we ended up. It's every fourth turning is different, and this one will also be different, but I think there are basic morphology that we look at, and that's what we look at in our book. What are the patterns of these eras that we can recognize? What are the basic kind of guideposts as we move through them?
So we just got a couple of minutes here, but this conversation could go on for a long time. But I guess, in your opinion now, I mean, where we are currently, how long do you think we have until this next reset? Is this something that's a decade away, 2 decades away,
next year? No, I think,
year?
You know, the reset will be, I think, complete mate within 10 to 15 years at the most. You know, that's how long we have left in this particular, you know, generation-long era.
Mm-hmm.
And my only kind of additional thought I would add is that I think it's important for people to recognize not everything is bad in a fourth turning. One of the things we point out in fourth turnings was that in family life and in cultural life, there are often some very positive trends. And one of the things that we notice today in America, the very positive trends often go overlooked. One thing I often point out is an enormous decline in violence and risk-taking among youth. It's probably been the swiftest decline in youth violence, meaning, you know, youth crime in American history over the past 15 or 20 years. We live in a much safer society today than in the mid-1990s. And we also see the return of things such as multi-generational living, which is not just pushed by the economy. We have young people now who get along really a lot better with their parents than boomers did with their own parents.
Oh, come on, Neil. They can't afford to move out of the house. That's what's really going on here.
Well, that may be true in the Houston area. But it's not. We've looked carefully at the data, and it's just amazing today. You know, millennial young adults and their boomer kids are, you know, they're wearing the same brand name clothing. They're syncing their iPods. They're watching the same movies. They're on the cell phone every day. It's a very different relationship than it was that we had, you know, back in the 70s and 80s. And I think anyone who remembers that era has to acknowledge that.
Absolutely. Neil, thank you so much for your time. Let's do this again soon sometime.
Okay, you're welcome.
Appreciate it, Neil. Bye. Neil Howe, the author of The Fourth Turning, and this has been, I've read this book probably two or three times throughout the last, you know, a few years, I guess. I certainly encourage you to read if you've never read it, because it really goes to the heart of, you know, demography and what happens through generations and kind of what to expect.